Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carl, welcome you to Bantercast, today's podcast from the team behind the Banter series of public talks and events. This is Bantercast number 99, and it's the first of four legends in a row. We welcome Yota Motalingi to the Banter tent at Ballymaloe Litfest for a freewheeling, long-form conversation about his life and times. He'd much to say about tastes, lifestyles, his own rise to the top, and much more besides.
Hi everybody, welcome along to Banter here at Ballymaloe Literary Festival. I want to say a big thanks first of all to Rebecca from Litfest, who's been absolutely invaluable in terms of putting together Banter. Big round of applause for Rebecca, she rarely gets mentioned. She's going to love that, she's going to thump me for that. So please also, while you're giving rounds of applause, please welcome Mr. Yoram Ortlengi. I want to take you back to your childhood. I want to go back to Jerusalem for you as a boy.
Yeah.
Food plays a big part in Jewish culture. Did it play a big part in your life as a kid?
Not so much from a Jewish perspective, because we were not very traditional in our house. So I've written a lot about it and got myself into trouble with various people, especially Jewish people, over my life when I admitted to have eaten all sorts of things, animals whose name we shan't mention in this forum. But this feels quite safe here in Ireland. I don't know many kosher eaters in this room or this tent. But it's played a big part of my life. Food has, in a sense that there was an abundance of it and a lot of interesting things going on. My parents are from a European background, so we had my dad's Italian and my mom has got German ancestry, and we had a lot of European food, but in a sense the most interesting stuff was happening out on the streets.
Yeah.
Which is the kind of the Palestinian food culture is an incredible rich food culture. Which is probably more known in the West as Lebanese food, but it goes all around Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, what is called the Levant. It's got an incredibly rich food culture, which consists of, where to start, bulgur wheat and chickpeas and sesame seeds and sesame paste and pomegranates and pomegranate molasses and garlic and lemon, all the stuff that I like to cook with. And so that was all there.
So your first, I suppose, kind of like steps after you finished military service was, first of all, you were a journalist for a while, mm-hmm. which is like, as a fellow journalist, I'm kind of wondering what attracted you to the trade in the first place and why did you get out so fast?
You talk fast.
I know, so deep.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to tell you. I noticed. Yeah. Journalism, actually, I do like, what I like about journalism is current affairs. I still love current affairs. I follow it religiously. I talk about it to all my friends. I find it fascinating the way politicians run our world so badly. And so I've always had an interest in that. And so when I was at university, I did a master's degree in the humanities, philosophy and literature, and in the evenings I used to work at the news desk as a sub-editor. I used to get the news, rearrange it on the page, rewrite it, write headlines, etc. That was my job. So in a sense it was a part-time job, although I did it almost full-time, but I loved doing it. And the reason why I didn't carry on doing it, because I didn't see prospects. Not so much, I didn't want to be a journalist for the rest of my life. I wanted to do something a little bit different that involved less of the mind and more of the other parts of the body, and the visceral aspect of food, the touching and cutting and chopping and tasting is much more attractive to me than sitting in front of computer screen. Although these days I sit more in front of the computer screen, way more than I do cook. So yeah. that's 20 years later. So yeah. That's a different story.
Yeah, before you took up, I'm going to speak very slowly from now on because I'm conscious.
Speak as fast as you like.
Before you kind of, I suppose, went fully down the food route, you spent time in Amsterdam, and like, you know, it was there, you know, you say you cooked for your friends. Your friends liked to come around to your gaff because they knew full well there was going to be good food there. When you were cooking in Amsterdam, what were you cooking? What kind of food were you cooking?
So before Amsterdam, there was Tel Aviv. I moved from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv to study. And I used to live near a fruit and vegetable market in Tel Aviv. It's Carmel Market, which is a beautiful market, really sensational. Like, just like you imagine a Middle Eastern market, lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, lots of street food, cheese, like, you know, like Turkish cheeses with all the white, you know, in brine and all sorts of wonderful things. And also just a great food culture in a sense. So you could talk to people about food. So that was then. And people used to come over, poor students. I would make these big things because it was my only chance to kind of cook for was on a Friday night where people weren't kind of going to university or whatever. They came over and I cooked. So I got my love for vegetables then. When I moved to Amsterdam, obviously a very different story, not so many vegetables, but I started becoming a little bit more technical about it. So I did what many people do, is I bought a bunch of French cookery books and started to learn a little bit about the theory. A lot of it was a waste of time in hindsight because I never needed to do so much brunoise chopping apart from that time. But it gave me the repertoire, you know, in my head at least. And and then I just cooked whatever I could. I mean, there's wonderful fish in Holland, so I used to use a lot of local fish. And just, you know, whatever I could come out, put my hands on.
Mm. You were saying, you know, there's not many vegetables in Amsterdam. And like, did you find its food scene to be kind of like slow? Did you find its food scene to be advanced? Like, I mean, besides the cooking you were doing at home for your friends, what about around Amsterdam?
So in a sense, when I'm interviewed, I'm asked, I came to London in 1997 and I came to Amsterdam in 1995, and people say, oh, food in London must have been terrible when you arrived. And I always say, in a sense, yes, it wasn't like this renaissance that we've got at the moment, but there was always great food to be had. You know, you just need to know where to look. And mostly it's the immigrants that have great food. So, you know, there was always great curries and places to go in East London to eat. And same for Amsterdam. You know, Amsterdam has got the equivalent of India to Amsterdam is Indonesia. So there was a lot of Indonesian food everywhere. So the rice tafels, you know, the big spreads of great food that you have in Indonesian cuisine, that was where I used to go and eat in Holland. And there are really good Dutch foods, you know, apple cakes, apple tarts are the most amazing. What they do with fish, the mackerels and the herrings. I mean, there's, if you want to find good food, you find good food. And I fell in love with something that I still adore, and that's croquettes, Spanish style, but Dutch style. And the Dutch have kind of ruined it a little bit because they like everywhere in the world, there's a fast food version, and this fast food version comes from a vending machine. So if you're really drunk in the middle of the night, you go to this vending machine, and you get these warm croquettes coming out. They're really terrible, but they taste delicious. I mean, they're just like, in that state, everything tastes delicious. But it's something that I will never forget. I guess it's just part of Dutch culinary culture, whether you like it or not.
Before you headed off to London, you know, you there's a piece in that New Yorker profile of you, and you talk about sending your thesis back to your father.
Yeah,
you tucked the note into the pages saying, hey dad, or hey father, I'm going to go to London to study food. How did he react? Because I'm sure he expected you at that stage, you'd done a thesis on the ontological status of the photographic image in aesthetic and analytic philosophy. I'm sure he was expecting a very different career for you.
Well, I'm glad you quoted the whole title of my thesis, because I wouldn't be able to. But my dad was not happy. But my dad is a gentle soul, and he's always been very gracious and very, very gentle. So in a sense, his disapproval came in a very mild-mannered way. You know, we had a conversation on the phone, and he said, look, I'm really, I, you know, do what you want to do, but I just want to warn you against wasting the rest of your life on this thing. Because when my dad comes from a traditionally Italian, or middle-class Italian family, and for them, the people who cooked were the staff. And it was my dad. The funny thing is, my dad, I got my love for cooking from my dad. That's the paradox. I mean, he always loved to cook, and he still does. He's 80 something now. And And that kind of sensibility, you know, the idea that you can really understand food and work with it and be and get immerse yourself in the experience is what I've got from him and from my mom, but very much from my dad. And the fact that he didn't like the idea was really not so much because not for the love of food, but just from the anxiety of a Jewish parent, you know, like what's going to happen to you, you know, like how low can you get, you know? So that was the worry, but it was a very genuine worry. And the end of this story is that when I turned 40, quite a while ago, I had a big party, and my friends all my partner arranged a big party, a big weekend, and everyone around the table gave me a little piece of advice or a little wished me something for my birthday, and the last person to talk was my father, and he said to me, "Well, I'm not going to give you any more advice now because the last time I gave you a serious piece of advice it was a complete bullshit." So now, and he said that, so now I'll let you be. You know, you've done well, and congratulations. It was very nice because kind of he admitted that he's not very good at foreseeing and giving advice for me for my future. It was brilliant.
So it's 1997 then, and you've moved from Amsterdam to London, and you're training in London. You're going down the full Cornblue route. You're going down the proper route. How quickly did it become apparent to you that this wasn't for you?
This was for me.
Yeah, sorry, this was for you. Yeah.
maybe it wasn't. I've done. Maybe I shouldn't be here. well, actually, it's good you phrase the question like that, because actually it was quite clear for a while that it wasn't for me, because it was too much hard work. Not in the sense that I found working in kitchens that I didn't enjoy not a pleasant experience. And in a sense, I was fooled to believe that in order to be really good at what I needed to become, I needed to go through this very intense experience of. So I started working in a Michelin star restaurant as a pastry chef or an assistant to a pastry chef, and it was really, really hard. I worked from, I don't know, 7 o'clock in the morning until after 10 or 11, five times, and sometimes 6 days a week, but not with people that I wanted to be, and not an environment that I wanted to be, not cooking the food that I enjoyed doing, and it became a bit of a nightmare. But everybody told me, if you don't do that, you won't become a good chef. So I carried on and did it for a few months, and then I just couldn't anymore because it was just not enjoyable at all. And I started looking for different jobs. And then after about 2 years, I started working for Rowley Lee, who's a very important chef in London. And he had a restaurant called Kensington Place in Kensington in London, and a couple of other restaurants. And over there, all of a sudden, things look a little bit different. I could still work kind of normal hours. It's hard working in restaurants, but rather than 16, it was 12 and 5 days a week. And it was all much more pleasant. It was much more about the food than anything else. And people don't realize that a lot in the old kind of French way of looking in a Michelin star restaurant, it was so much about building character and for so little about food. And when I started working for Rowley and the Kensington Place, I realized that it could be so much more about the food and not the rest of the stuff. And that was really an eye-opener. And then I found a great job at a place called Baker & Spice in West London, which was, again, it was a deli and a patisserie shop where cooking and working with food was just pure fun, you know? And I realized that, and that's why whenever I meet young people and they say, do I really need to work in horrible hotels for like 5 years in order to get the experience I need? I said, no, you don't really have to. There's all sorts of alternative routes. It doesn't need to be the idea of a nightmare that some people think it should be. I mean, you work hard, and I did, but it doesn't need to be something that you really don't enjoy.
Mm. You mentioned Baker & Spice there. That's where you met Sammy, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I met Sammy at Baker & Spice. So Sammy is my kind of... I don't know how to describe him. He's one of my business partners, but he's also the person that has really kind of the creative collaboration is what started both of our careers, our collaboration. And he's a very close friend and a business partner. And in a sense, the whole Ottolenghi thing has come out of our collaboration. Sammy is a brilliant chef, and I was mainly doing baking and sweets. And when we teamed up together, when you started Ottolenghi, it was all about this collaboration. He cooked fresh food and I baked fresh cakes, and we put it out on the counter, and lo and behold, everybody thought it was fantastic, and we were very happy. So the whole I think I wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for him and this collaboration that still exists.
Well, did he work in Baker & Spice or did he actually own it?
No, he worked there. He was running the kitchen, the savory department. I applied for a job as a pastry cook. I worked as a pastry chef for a few places by then, a couple of years, 3 years, and he was there working, but the manager was not around. So he was the first person who took my CV when I popped in to give it to hand it in. And so he said, well, the manager's not here, I'll pass it on to her. I said, well, that's fine, thank you. And but then we started talking and we realized we've got much more in common than we thought. You know, we literally were born in the same year in the same city and followed very similar routes up to that moment. So that was really kind of uncanny in a sense, like you meet someone who's almost like your twin that you've never met. And over the years, we've found more and more things that we have in common, the age, the sensibilities, the whole thing is like, it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, like, so basically, the two of you meet, you're starting work there. How quickly did the conversation turn to working together on something else? And who was the prime mover? Was it your ambition or was it Sammy's ambition?
No, Sammy didn't have that ambition. It was a little bit complicated because Sammy and I are like the faces of this thing, but actually there was a third partner called Noam, and he was the business mind behind this. I'm not a business person, and I don't have I have too much anxiety to be. I would never, if you'd ask me when I was younger if I'd have a business, I said no, I couldn't. I need a salary in the bank. I could not be, you know, I could not do this. But Noam is a great old friend, and him and I set the business together. And Sammy was not supposed to join us until it was about 2 weeks or 3 weeks before opening. And he was involved throughout, like going to see places with us, but he was going to stay at Baker & Spice. And then at some point, he just, I think, I don't know what it was exactly. He realized that we're more serious than we seem to be, you know, because we were in like our 20s setting up a business and he was getting a salary and feeling comfortable at Baker & Spice and having a good position. But I think he thought, actually, these guys are going to do something. So he joined us.
Yeah.
That's why it's my name on the door and not his. That's what's kind of, that's how it what happened.
I mean, you said that he's part of that Ottolenghi thing. And like the Ottolenghi thing, as you kind of put it so nicely there, it's just become this. It's shorthand for so many things. It's shorthand for so many things. It's shorthand for a way of cooking. It's shorthand for an approach to cooking, type of ingredients. How quickly do you think it took off? I mean, can you kind of trace back and go, okay, it was because of X, Y, or Z that this thing actually accelerated?
There is a looking back, because I have given this some thought. I think initially it started off as things do, quite small. We were maybe four or five people in the kitchen and three people upstairs. So it's a team of maybe 10 altogether started cooking and baking fresh food. But I think it became a little thing when the, you know, the middle class residents of Notting Hill realized that they love it and became a talking piece in the neighborhood, and that didn't take very long. It only took a few weeks. I think we started in July, and by the September there were queues, which was really well beyond our expectations. We didn't really know what to expect. It was small. It was kind of, it was just a little deli. We didn't know that it's going to grow, so that was kind of a milestone where we looked at the bottom line at the end of the day. We go like, my God, this is like amazing. You know, we never expected that, and then a couple of years later, maybe 3 or 4 years later, the Guardian asked me to write a vegetarian column, and I think that was the next big thing, because then it left the confines of kind of a small neighborhood in West London. And became a national thing. I mean, and again, I don't know how to describe it, as I use a very stupid word thing, but because I don't like the word brand, and I don't like the word, bigger words than that. But I think for people, Ottolenghi conjures up all sorts of things. For me, it's my family name, so I never know exactly how to describe it. But the Guardian column, which was all about fresh vegetables, simple cooking in a vegetarian style that was not familiar people prior to that moment, was the next big moment. That was in 2006 or so.
Yeah.
And I think that was pretty momentous, in the sense that all of a sudden you could start saying things about it. It's vegetables, it's Middle Eastern ingredients, it's fresh, it's kind of, it does new things. It's very middle class. Well, there's a certain number of adjectives that are used in that context.
Yeah, let's take each one of those adjectives one by one. Let's start with the vegetarian one. Like when you started the column, you said you're apprehensive about writing about vegetables and, quote, running out of ideas, about being pigeonholed, about getting bored and hungry. I mean, that hasn't proven to be the case.
Quite the opposite.
Did you kind of like, I mean, how apprehensive were you? I mean, you know, this was when the Guardian wants you to write about, join them, there was one opening. That was the person writing about vegetables.
Yeah. It was a tiny column. And in a sense, I thought, you know, we wanted to do a cookbook before the Guardian column came up. And I met with a couple of publishers, and everybody wanted to, they thought we were doing something rather special, but they all wanted it they didn't have the confidence to kind of invest in a proper book, so they wanted to include it. One publisher, actually, not more than one, offered to include it in a series of books about meat, fish, vegetables, and they wanted us to do the vegetable part. And I said, no, look, I don't want to be part of a series like that. And, you know, we're busy enough. It doesn't have to happen. And so we put that idea to the side. And then when The Guardian approached, I think it kind of felt that they were going to do the same thing as that publisher wanted to do, and then say, okay, you guys, that's nice what you're doing. Those are nice mountains of vegetables. Write a vegetable column for us, and that's what. And I was worried that it's like a role you play in a film. Like, that's it. I'm going to be the vegetarian chef. And in those days, to be a vegetarian chef, and it's not a long time ago. It's only about 10 years, but the world has really shifted since. For various reasons, but to be a vegetarian chef was like not a real good chef to be. when I worked in restaurants, this was like, it's literally, I mean, people talk about it a lot, but when the vegetarian diner came in, it was like, everybody's like, so, you know, what are we going to do with that one now? You know, like, so, you know, all the creative minds got together and they brought some aubergines and grilled them and did a stack and, you know, and served it out there with some goat's cheese and, you know, and that was as far as it went. And it felt a little bit risky. You know, I just started my career as a chef and to take on that role, I did have very high aspirations, but the idea that I'm going to be vegetarian for the rest of my cooking life was a little bit intimidating, a little bit like, well, maybe, yes. But so my agent, the one that was trying to promote the book, said, well, look, it's a really good opening. And she said, beggars can't be choosers. Take the column, for God's sake, and write something about vegetables, which I did. But I think what happened is that actually I was completely wrong in my assessment, because I thought, you know, writing a vegetarian column is actually writing recipes for vegetarians. And I think this was when I went wrong. I realized after quite a short while, maybe 6 months or a year, that actually not only vegetarians read my column and cook my food, it was actually just the general public enjoyed those recipes for what they are. And I think that realization and the way that went forward actually saved me from what I was fearing the most, and that I'm going to become kind of the chef of the health food shop, you know.
Because that was the thing at the time. I mean, vegetarian restaurants were seen as the health food shop. I'm trying to think back then, there's probably the Gate was open at that stage in London. There was very few kind of good vegetarian restaurants until you came along and entered.
Very few. And the people that did vegetarian food belonged to a kind of a school of thought where it's not only about eating vegetables. There's also a sense of a kind of puritanism involved in approach to food. It's not only about, I'm not only going to eat vegetables, but I'm also going to hate a little bit myself about my life. And I mean, I shouldn't be really doing the sensual things of life in life. You know, it's like, so I wouldn't season my vegetables because why would I? Because I only eat vegetables, you know, all those kind of things. But it's true. Those vegetables were not seasoned. You know, if you used to go to the old Fresh and Wild in the 1990s, you got your tofu block, your lentils, your rice, your whole grain, bulgur, whatever, and it wasn't seasoned. For some reason, I don't know why, it still baffles me. So in a sense, I think all those things are really bygones now, luckily. Totally. And people realize the vegetables. And then now we're kind of almost at the end of the journey, not quite, but I think we're nearing. all the best cooks in the world cook vegetables, and they're very proud of cooking vegetables and challenging themselves nonstop. With that, what I felt was, after writing for a while, that I can really, actually, the fact that my choice was narrowed down almost arbitrarily by The Guardian was a real benefit. I could really go and explore this field. And I think a lot of chefs see that now. Yeah. All they've got is their beets and their carrots and their tomatoes and their rice and their bulgur and their barley, and they can do wonders with it. Mm. And that's what they go and do.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's about limitations. I mean, Brian Eno has great quotes about that the more you limit someone, the better they kind of force themselves to be.
Yeah, and I think it was really liberating in a sense, because I knew I had this, this was the limit, this was what I could do, this is what I could work with, and that's it. And then you sit there and you hold your hand and your head in your hands, and then you go like, that's what I'm going to do. And then you sit there and some bright ideas come up somehow. It's just the nature of things.
The second thing you mentioned about the Ottolenghi thing was the ingredients. And my sister-in-law, Anna, is a big fan of yours, but she just, because giving out time after time about the ingredients, we give up. We just bought her an Ottolenghi hamper every Christmas. That's one way around it.
Yeah.
And I think
you should carry on with that.
Exactly. We'll talk a little bit maybe about
it's
discount
a great Christmas
afterwards,
present,
okay?
Yeah.
You had a great quote about this. You said that every year has its own ingredients that are considered exotic, and then 15 years later, they're not.
Yeah.
You've had a big effect on take Britain and Ireland, in terms of what the stuff people have. It's just the ingredients you now use are stocked at supermarkets, for example. You know, talk a little bit about that and how that feels.
So the 15 years are like 15 months now, because of the way things move so fast these days, because the information moves so much faster. So anything that is considered unusual and interesting could show up on your supermarket shelf anytime, really, and that's a beautiful thing. Sometimes it's always almost to the extreme, because the trouble is often, because there's this craze for new things, which I'm aware that I contribute to, the supermarkets stock it one day and then 3 weeks later it's a new thing, and then you go like, where are those? What we were looking for, Scully, the other day, the Waitrose and so it used to stock the not phyllo but the other one, the brick pastry, and all of a sudden they stop and go like, well, everybody discovered brick, and then all of a sudden there was no brick. I think it's because Delia doesn't do her shows anymore, and she was like, but more seriously, that's how it is. So things appear on shelves, and the exotic is not exotic anymore, and people can enjoy and can benefit, and it's mostly good.
Yeah, the third identifier you kind of mentioned earlier on was class and middle class, and the fact that Ottolenghi recipe and Ottolenghi restaurant deli was seen as middle class. That's changed. Is that changing, or is that still kind of intact?
I think just like vegetables, I think that way a slightly more complex view of food has kind of left the middle classes a little bit and trickled down or up, or whichever way you want to see it, into different places. And I do see that more people eat different things. I mean, the variety has grown in all places. I mean, we still have a problem with what people eat. I think the biggest problem is not so much the ingredients. The biggest problem is ready-made food, which is, I think this is what, you know, everybody's talking these days about particular ingredients. I don't think it's particular ingredients. I think it's industrialized food, which is still the biggest problem. The fact that we eat things that we have no idea what goes into them. And I've never been a preacher, and I don't think I'll ever become a preacher. But for me, it's the stuff that I can't pronounce on packages that is the biggest, that's the biggest threat. Nothing exotic, nothing too sugary or too fatty or too this. It's all this stuff that I don't know what it is. That's where I draw the line, you know. That's it's just wrong.
I mean, I suppose going back to the kind of the idea of what an Ottolenghi recipe is, and one of the things is definitely kind of Middle Eastern. It's definitely kind of coming from kind of different countries. And you did a very interesting interview conversation with the people who wrote the Gaza cookbook.
Yeah,
and it was fascinating because you were talking a lot in that about appropriation, where foods come from.
Yeah.
The fact that they changed so much. And you were giving some very interesting examples about foodstuffs which may be considered Palestinian or Syrian that actually were in many ways North African, Jewish in many ways.
Yeah.
So is that something that you've thought about a lot? And it's something that's come up as an issue.
Yeah. Well, it comes up in an issue all the time, because when Sammy and I were writing the Jerusalem cookbook, we had to ascribe a source or tradition to a particular recipe. So we go like, okay, there's the familiar things like falafel, and then there's all sorts of kibbeh and all sorts of things that are very particular to different parts of the Middle East, and are a feature in Jerusalem cooking. And they feature in Jerusalem cooking because Jerusalem is full of immigrants, you know, mostly Jews that have come since the beginning of the 20th century and up until this day. Now, it's a multi-ethnic, but mostly it's a two-religion city of Muslims and Jews. And the difficulty is obviously, as we all know, they don't live together in peace. And everything seems to be a threat on your existence on both sides. I mean, everybody is afraid. I mean, it comes off as aggression, but actually everybody's terrified for their own future. So food is one of the things that you cling on when you feel that your existence is in danger. And so that's why people feel very strongly about it. Obviously, the Palestinians, when Jews or Israelis claim to have a certain food that has been on their plates for, you know, millennia as their own, so that is a huge threat when your existence is a threat. And vice versa, I mean, Jews that have felt that they have been, kicked out of wherever they were and end up in Israel, and then all of a sudden someone said, that's actually not your food, even though you come from, you know, Jews have been in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq for also as long as Arabs did. But they cook the same thing. And then someone says, oh, no, actually you don't. Hummus is not yours, it's ours. Everybody feels very threatened. And when you feel threatened, you behave aggressively and you behave controllingly, and you want to have a sense that appropriation. You know, you want to know that this belongs to you and that's that. So it was always working a very fine line. Who are you going to ascribe ownership to? And with Sami and I often said, well, look, this. So we broke it down. So there is this version that is a Jewish version from Tripoli, and then you'd have this is a Muslim version from Morocco or bits of Morocco, and this is a Palestinian dish. And so we would try to kind of break it down as knowledgeably as we could and as sensitively as we could. But you always step on someone's toes. I even did it with Irish food. Yeah.
What you do with Irish
food? Well, because my partner is from Northern Ireland, I eat sometimes. My mum often cooks for us. His mum. And so I try to do my version of Irish stew on Irish stew and my version on a bread, a soda bread. And Guardian readers got really upset because I messed with old traditional recipes. And
I find Irish Guardian readers get very upset about things very easily.
It was the English Guardian readers that were protecting the guy. There was no Irish there. There was all, how very dare you? I've got an Irish friend and they don't cook their stew like that. Never will have orange skin inside their Irish stew. Yeah, but you know, if I would cook a traditional Irish stew, I mean, who would buy the paper? I mean, it's like... So I always get into trouble with all sorts of people from various parts of the world because I mess up with their recipes. The only recipes that I'm not allowed to mess with are the recipes I grew up with. Those are holy. Nobody can touch them. No, not even Mary Berry.
I want to go back to something you said there earlier on. You said that you're not a businessman. You never set out to be a businessman. Yet these days you're kind of fronting a very large business. How, like, what are your duties on a day-to-day basis within the Ottolenghi Empire? Aside from not insulting Irish people.
Well, that's my job. Yeah. What I'm very proud of is that we created a company that I think really nourishes talent, and I'm not talking about my talent. We're a partnership. We've got four main partners, and we've got people working with us. One of them sits here, that's Scully, and he's co-written the Nopi Cookbook with me. And what we do, I think, quite well is let people do their stuff. And I think that is how we manage to grow. Mm. So not everything comes from Sami or from me. A lot of the stuff comes from people that work with us. I've got a test kitchen in Camden, and we've got quite a few people working there, contributing their ideas, working together. And it's that has really worked for us in terms of I can spend time being here and doing all those things and writing recipes while other people do a lot of the things that I should be doing. And I'm not saying that in a kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek way, but it's actually true that there is a lot of that happening. And any person who comes to our little universe realizes immediately that, I am the name and I am the face. But actually a lot of people do very exciting things all the time. Mm. And if you come to my test kitchen and people have visited, they are always surprised to see how people just bring their own thing. I mean, the whole Nopi cookbook is really the story of this man. I mean, in a sense, you know, that kind of bringing your own into our world is really important for me. Mm.
So what do you look for then in terms of like chefs? I mean, there was a panel earlier on, and John Renahan from kind of like Holy Smoke and Cork was talking about how hard it is to get chefs right now. And I'm just curious, like, I mean, what do you look for in a chef? And is it hard to find people who to actually work with and to train up?
It's hard. What is hard about chefs, finding chefs and keeping chefs, is that it's a very transient job in this point in history. People come, they learn, they move on. I mean, I cannot blame anyone, because I've gone through the same process, and that's kind of the way it works in this industry. You go and work under a certain chef organization, you learn what you need to learn, then you move on. So we have different chefs. So people come to you at various stages in their career. Some people come very early on, and you don't expect them to stay very long. But some people come in their you know, early 30s or late 30s, and then often these people stay for longer because you offer them positions of responsibility or creativity, and they stay. And the smart thing is to learn how to tailor positions for people within the organization so they stay. And I think we do that pretty well now, and we only learned the hard way, because a lot of good people left and took the knowledge with them. Not took it in a negative sense, but you know that all that investment kind of dissipates to somewhere else. So we really try to keep, in my test kitchen, I've got kind of Ottolenghi veterans that have had enough working shifts, and they come and work with me on developing recipes, which is more creative but a little bit less, you know, evening shifts and weekend shifts. So we move people around, give them new challenges, offer them new positions, and that's how we get around it. But you need to grow to a certain size in order to be able to do it. And I think one of the drives for growth is talent. When you've got someone that is good, you kind of give them an opportunity and try to do something with them and for them. Like I said to you, it wouldn't have happened if it was only Sami and I that were doing what we do. We needed other people to give their contribution.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, besides the Guardian column and coming to places like this and the restaurants, the other way, like, I mean, you kind of, like, present your face to the public is through the cookbook, you know?
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering, like, I mean, you know, there was a very interesting discussion earlier on that Carolyn Hennessy had about Cookbook Chronicles and talking to people about cookbooks. And there was a cookbook editor called Kristen Jensen. She was saying a good cookbook should be, like, having a friend in the kitchen, you know, someone who's kind of talked you through the recipe. Like, do you have any idea? Like, what are your thoughts about cookbooks? What are the ones you like? And, like, I mean, should it be? Are your books aimed to be kind of like that aid in the kitchen?
I have a lot of thoughts about cookbooks because I've thought about it a lot from the beginning. And Scully and I, again, I refer to him because it's a very fresh experience for us to write a cookbook. And the Nopi cookbook was different from the other cookbooks that I've published in many senses. So when I started publishing books in 2008, was when my first book was published, together with Sami, co-written. I somehow had that instinct that this book needs to be super usable, super useful for people in their home kitchens. I thought, if I'm going to create something, I really don't want any ambiguity there. I want to hold people by their hand, and no matter how good they are or how bad they are at cooking, I want to be able to offer them maximum safety net. And for me, it's very important, because so that's why I don't assume anyone knows anything. And someone wrote, I claim not to read the talkbacks in The Guardian, but I really do. So
everyone says that, yeah, and everyone does read
them.
Yeah,
even today, someone says, eighth of a teaspoon, WTF. You know, like, what? Why do I need to know eighth of a teaspoon? Can you not just write a pinch? But then you'd have another reader say, right, what's a pinch? So, you know, you can never win, especially with Guardian readers. So in a sense, I just go for the safe. I measured my salt. This is how much I think there should be there. You do what you like. And for me, it's very important, because I want to make sure that people could recreate what I made to the closest proximity to what it was. I know when you cook, you can go astray in so many ways. The size of the tray when you roast something is crucial. If it's massive, everything is going to dry out. If it's small, the moisture that you have in whatever you're roasting, meat or fish or vegetable, will create a completely different cooking result. It's crucial. But then people go, oh, you're a complete idiot, because you say, does the tray really need 24 by 30? No, it doesn't. But if you want to get what I got, then it needs to be 24 by 30, because that's the size of tray that I used on that day when I cooked that dish. So it's all about what you want for your reader. And I think, yes, you don't need to follow my recipes at all. I really don't feel very strongly about it. But if someone wants to and get a result that is as close as possible to what I got, then here you go. All the information is there. And a small onion weighs 120 grams.
That is the best fact ever to come out of a banter interview. 120 grams, the ideal weight for a small onion. Final question, and thank you very much for your time. Apologies for talking fast at the start. I need to slow down a little bit.
Okay.
Final question, do you have a bucket list? Are there things on your kind of like list to do? Like aside from the daily chores of putting up shelves or whatever, but are there ambitions you have?
I want to take a pottery course. I want to learn how to make pots and plates and stuff. So this is, I'm planning on going in October on a week of learning how to do work with clay.
Excellent.
Is that a good one?
That's great.
Thank
that's
you.
Great. That on the weight of the onion. Jorm Jan Lingi, thank you very much.
Many thanks to Jorm for taking the time to join us at Banter, and thanks to Rebecca and all at Ballymaloe for their help. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast from another legend. Until then, goodbye and take care.